your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler. We're at a nexus, at a sea change, I would say, in this nation that's coming over, is changing over very quickly to a much more conservative regime headed up by Donald Trump. The American people spoke out loudly and clearly on November 8th that they wanted a change. So I think we're going to see a sea change occur in many ways. Donald Trump, President-elect Donald Trump, is in the process of appointing and selecting a group of appointees, not only cabinet positions, but many other posts that are not necessary to have Senate confirmation on. And so at this time, we're going to be taking a look, you know, at some of those appointees over between now and the time he's inaugurated. And then when he begins administration on January the 1st, 2017, there are people out there expressing on talk radio many differing views about whether or not there are too many Goldman Sachs appointees that are being considered. And also recently there was an election of a resolution within the United Nations Security Council. 2334 passed. And Trump took a resistance to that or opposition to that, even as president-elect, and was saying things to the Egyptian United Nations representative about perhaps pulling that particular resolution before the final vote. There's been a controversy about the West Bank settlements that the Israelis have been installing and building. You could say been building for a number of decades. The Palestinians have been in opposition, fierce opposition at times to these settlements, and that has fueled some of the problems between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Now, Trump is considering a Friedman fella, and he is hardline right on settlements. So he's also expressed to other individuals, President-elect Trump, that these people are going to be working for him. So he, believes and expects them to carry out his own wishes. But right now, he's got under consideration so many Goldman Sachs people, some that are the chief operating officer of Goldman Sachs at this time, that for them to act totally independent of those financial interests, which they've spent years and decades supporting, and they've all made a fortune out of many of their financial dealings and so forth. But there again, Goldman Sachs not only represents a large, very powerful company within the financial sector, but the annual meeting of the Bilderberg Group takes place annually, and it's being held in Europe right now the last few times. It's been held here in the United States a few times in the last 5-6 years, but it seemed to be going over to Dresden was the last meeting held last end of May, June, 1st of June. They usually hold their meetings between the end of May and the 1st of July within that weekend period right there. But usually at these meetings, you'll have, I've seen up to 6 members of the Goldman Sachs team there, you know. So what we're seeing here is a company that has an extraordinary large influence on that Bilderberg Group level. And the Bilderberg Group level has kings and queens there, or their emissaries, you could say at times. They have the Bank of England director, the Military Intelligence 6, MI6 there. They have usually the top general, U.S. general in NATO there, and so forth. So these people together are, you know, could say they're trading information, advice on how to run the world and what decisions to make in the future. But they're outside of, they're acting outside of their normal designated appointed government positions. This is where they're acting in secrecy. They do not make public any of their decisions or any of their discussions. And so we don't know exactly what they're up to all the time, but they represent tremendous oil interest, banking interest, government interest, central bank interest. So they're bound to coalesce together, you could say, into supporting their own financial and corporate interests worldwide. And these are truly the internationalists, see. And what is really puzzling in a way is that these are the very people that resisted, supposedly, this Trump's run for the presidency. And so these very powerful people, they coalesced around, concentrated and collected around Hillary as their, you know, candidate. She had the power, the money power. She had BlackRock behind her, which is $4.5 trillion management asset manager in the world, which is the largest asset management company in the world. So you had a lot of the intelligence people and so forth that she got a list of that were defiantly against Trump, see. And so all of a sudden, he's starting to appoint maybe as a peace, gesture, a goodwill gesture of peace. But there are just too many now. When you start off with 2 or 3 Goldman Sachs, that's okay. But 5 or 6, it's getting into a number now which says that they're going to control him with the men around him. If they can't control a man like Trump, who has a mind of his own, I think he means well for this country. Basically, I think he wants to establish a legacy while he's in the office of the presidency, one that will be good for his reputation, and I think a good American. I think Trump is a good American. He's very ambitious, and he has this ego thing that rears its ugly head at times. But overall, I think he's a loyal American and will do the right thing for the country. Whether or not these men surrounding him will give advice as to what's good for the country or what's good for their own interest. And these people are into the billionaire range and millionaire range. So their interests are many and varied, and I just don't know if they can totally exclude themselves from those financial and those vested interests totally. And wouldn't they have that bias anyway when they gave him, they have a cabinet, say, meeting? Wouldn't they be biased anyway in certain ways? We know that all men and all the human nature is such that we're all biased in certain ways, and we're not going to easily give up those biases, see. So this remains to be seen whether or not we're going to have, a Trump administration that we're seeing that he's going to do some things that are pretty obvious, like immigration. That's a no-brainer. That has to be done to preserve our country. And tax relief. Things like that, those are pretty obvious things and trying to cut down on the corruption. He can only drain the swamp a little bit. He's not going to do away with all the corruption. It is so insidiously involved in all levels of government. And the money is so great too, you know, on these projects. I think from a good business management viewpoint, I think he's putting together a team that can manage things better than Obama has done. Financially managed. And that might be the saving grace of the Trump administration. And there are certain major things, I think, that he can probably get done. See, he said he was against the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. I think that's an absolute must. But now, one of the things that's just recently passed Congress has been the National Defense Authorization Act. And that is a real, real bad act. And it's a bad act because it can arrest citizens, American citizens, with indefinite detention, you know, as long as for the remaining period of hostilities or something like that. So I'm going to be playing here a 33-minute and 55-second digital, you know, a segment here of three senators that stood up, Feinstein and Lee, Senator Lee and Senator Rand Paul, on the floor of the Senate and object. They tried to get through an amendment to the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act of 2017, that would take away that indefinite detention, you know, clause in there, but they were not successful in doing that. And so it remains to be seen how President Trump, President-elect Trump, but President Trump, when he's the president, will handle the NDAA. Will he support that, or will he support amendments to it, or whatever? But he comes down somewhat on the authoritarian side. His personality type comes down on the authoritarian personality type, meaning that probably he had a very strong father. He had the military academy training. So he's pretty well on that disciplined authoritarian side. And whether or not he can try to come over and start looking at things from the average citizen viewpoint and the citizen rights and the citizen's freedoms and liberties remains to be seen. And this is, I think, going to be some of the inner conflicts that President-elect Trump is going to be experiencing as he works from a promotional, entrepreneurial, real estate wheeler-dealer, television personality, to try to shuck off somewhat of those ego types of problems, and try to move towards being a statesman and becoming the president, or becoming a real president in the presidency of the United States. And so anyway, I'm going to play that now, and I hope you will listen very carefully, and then I'll come back and we'll discuss what's going on a little bit more, and then we'll end the program. But this is our first hour. I'm going to repeat the technocracy discussion I had about technocracy rising with Patrick Wood that I had last week. I just think it's too big an issue. And it's beginning to be bandied around the Internet, I noticed, by own people from other talk shows. So technocracy is beginning to be acknowledged, and people are becoming aware, some of your hosts and so forth, talk show hosts out there. But it's a very, very important thing. It's managing a society along energy and metering out measurement of energy and manipulation and the withdrawing or providing of energy resources and so forth, instead of a democracy, democratic republic like we have now. So it's one of these high-tech types of things, but that's not really good for this country. But anyway, I'm going to let you listen to this. These were three senators fighting last June on the floor of the Senate. They didn't get their amendment through, and they've had some really problems in trying to do this. It should have been a slam dunk situation. But anyway, listen to that closely right now.
Mr. President.
Senator from Utah.
Mr. President, I rise today to discuss and to urge my colleagues to support Amendment number 4448, the Due Process Guarantee Amendment. This amendment addresses a little-known problem that I believe most Americans would be shocked to discover even exists. Under current law, the federal government has proclaimed the power, has arrogated to itself the power to detain indefinitely, without charge or trial, U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents who are apprehended on American soil. Let that sink in for just a minute. If you're a U.S. citizen or a U.S. green card holder and you're arrested on American soil because you're suspected of supporting a terrorist group or other enemy of the United States, the federal government has claimed the power to detain you indefinitely without formally charging you or without offering you a trial. I'm not talking about American citizens who travel to foreign lands to take up arms against the United States military and are captured on the battlefield. No, I'm talking here about U.S. citizens who are apprehended right here in the United States of America. Under current law, even they can be imprisoned for an unspecified, in fact, unlimited period of time without ever being charged or being given the benefit the trial without the benefit of a jury trial to which they are entitled. You don't need to be a defense attorney to recognize what an outrage this is. Arresting U.S. citizens on American soil and then detaining them indefinitely without charge or trial is an obvious deviation from the constitutional right to due process of law. The last time the federal government exercised such power, during the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, without congressional authorization, Congress responded by passing a law to prevent it from happening again. Of course, such legal protection should not need to be codified into federal statute in the first place, but they did it anyway. Now, the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution states in no uncertain terms that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. But then again, as James Madison reminded us, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. So in the wake of World War II, Congress passed and President Nixon signed the Non-Detention Act of 1971, which states, quote, no citizen shall be imprisoned or otherwise detained by the United States except pursuant to an act of Congress, close quote. Those last few words are absolutely crucial. Except pursuant to an act of Congress. The Non-Detention Act of 1971 recognized, as I believe most Americans do, that in some cases, in some grave, treacherous, unfortunate cases, indefinite detention of U.S. citizens may, in the eyes of some, be deemed necessary. But the point is that the federal government does not inherently possess the power of indefinite detention. To the extent such power can even be said to exist within our constitutional framework at all, a question that many of us would regard as at least debatable. Certainly, only an act of Congress, such as an authorization for the use of military force or AUMF, or perhaps a declaration of war, can give the federal government that power. But fast forward 40 years, and this important legal protection has eroded. You see, in 2011, 40 years after the passage of the Non-Detention Act of 1971, Congress passed its annual National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2012, the predecessor of the bill that we're considering today. In that version of the NDAA, there was a provision, Section 1021, giving the federal government the power to detain U.S. citizens indefinitely without trial, even those who were apprehended on American soil. Now, it may sound like Section 1021 meets the Act of Congress threshold established by the Non-Detention Act of 1971, but importantly, it does not. It does no such thing. Here's why. The language of Section 1021 merely presumes that the 2001 AUMF gives the federal government the right to detain U.S. citizens indefinitely without having to prove anything, even though an explicit grant of such power appears nowhere, nowhere at all, in the 2001 AUMF. My amendment would resolve this problem. In clear and straightforward language, my amendment clarifies that a general authorization to use military force, a declaration of war, or any similar authority on its own shall not be construed to authorize the imprisonment or detention without charge or trial of a citizen or lawful permanent resident of the United States apprehended in the United States. This means that if Congress believes it's necessary to have the power to indefinitely detain U.S. citizens who are captured in the U.S., then Congress must expressly say so in any authorization it passes. My amendment recognizes that the due process protections of U.S. citizens are far too important to leave up to implied legal contemplation. The 2001 AUMF does not expressly state that the federal government has the power to detain indefinitely U.S. citizens who were apprehended on American soil. It just doesn't say it. You can look at the 2001 AUMF and you will not find that. So if those who believe that it is somehow in the national security interest of the United States for the federal government to have that power, they should file an amendment to the AUMF that says so explicitly. And then we can see that the American people think, and we can find out just as importantly what their elected representatives in the House and in the Senate think. Or they can file an entirely new AUMF that provides such authority expressly. Now, Mr. President, this amendment, the one that I'm discussing today, this should not be controversial. In fact, in 2012, just a year after the initial offending provision that I described a moment ago was passed, the Senate passed this amendment with 67 votes, in large part thanks to the tireless efforts of my distinguished colleague, the senior senator from California, Senator Feinstein, who joins me as a co-sponsor of the amendment today. Unfortunately, the Due Process Guarantee Amendment was stripped from that version of the NDAA. The NDAA passed in 2012 for 2013 during the conference process. At the time, some opponents of the amendment were under the impression that it would extend due process protections to U.S. citizens apprehended outside the United States. But that, Mr. President, is undeniably false. The Due Process Guarantee Amendment applies only to U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents who are apprehended on U.S. soil. It has been 4 years since that misunderstanding prevented Congress from passing this common-sense bipartisan reform. That is more than enough time for this institution to gain clarity on what this amendment does do, and just as importantly, on what this amendment does not do. And so it's time, Mr. President, that we finally pass this amendment. And I urge each of my colleagues to do so.
Senator, you yield for a question?
Yes.
4 years ago, we passed legislation under the defense authorization that allows the American government to detain an American citizen without a trial. Think about that. One of our basic rights, one of our most important rights, is the right to a trial, to be represented, to have a jury of our peers. And you say, oh, well, it'll never be used. Well, President Obama recognized this. He said, this is a terrible power, and I promise never to use it. Any president who says a power is so terrible he's not going to use it should not be on the books. As the senator from Utah said, it's not about having laws that require angels to be in charge of your government. Someday there will be someone in charge of the government who makes a grievous mistake, like rounding up the Japanese. So we have to be very, very careful about giving power to our government. That's what the challenge is here. Many will say, well, we are at war, and at war you have to have the law of war. What is the law of war? Also known as martial law. But this is a war that does not seem to have an end. They're not asking you for a 1 or 2 year period in which there won't be trials. They are asking you to relinquish your right to trial for a war that may have no end. And I want you to imagine this. Who could these enemy combatants be that may not get trials? Imagine that you're an Arab American living in Dearborn, Michigan, and you send an email to someone overseas. Maybe that person is a bad person. Maybe there is a connection. But should not an Arab American in Dearborn, Michigan have a right to defend themselves in court and say, I was just sending an email to him and I said a few stupid things, but I'm not a terrorist? Shouldn't they get the right to defend themselves? We need to be very careful that as we fight this long war, that we don't wake up one day and say we won the war, but we lost what we stood for. We lost the Bill of Rights. We lost what our soldiers. I know soldiers who have lost two arms and a leg fighting for us, and they come back and they say they were fighting for the Bill of Rights. That's what this should be about, protecting the Bill of Rights while they're gone. And so the question I have for my esteemed colleague is, some will say, well, they get a hearing, they get a habeas hearing, they go before a judge. Isn't that due process? Is a habeas hearing equivalent to due process?
No, no. Now, due process can include habeas. But some might say habeas corpus is the beginning of due process, not the end. Sometimes it occurs at the beginning, sometimes at the end, but regardless of when in the process it occurs. A habeas proceeding does not represent the sum total universe of what due process means. Look, you can't read the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 8th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution to see that what happened in the version of the NDAA that we passed in 2011 was an affront to the constitutional order. It was an aberration. Now, we're not asking for anything drastic. All we are asking here is that before the government take this step, the type of drastic step that you're describing, that at a minimum, that we require Congress to expressly authorize that. Is that really too much? And for those who would say we're at war, we're under danger, and I understand the point. There are those who don't like our way of life. They perhaps want to do us harm. For those who would say that we are at war and we've got to take that into account and we've got to consider that, my response is, okay, if that's the case, then let's at least do it the way we're supposed to do it. Let's at least have that discussion rather than doing it by subterfuge, rather than doing it under a cloud of uncertainty, rather than doing it by implication. We need to do so expressly, and that's all this amendment does.
And let me clarify in a follow-up question. If an American citizen goes to Syria and fights with ISIS and is captured on the battlefield, this amendment would not mean that they get a trial.
No.
They still could be held as an enemy combatant.
That's correct. This would not cover that at all, because that person is outside the United States. That person is captured on the battlefield, a battlefield outside the United States. That person wouldn't be covered by this amendment.
And let's just also be clear what we're talking about. People who have been defined as enemy combatants aren't always holding a weapon. You can be a propagandist. For example, we have had propagandists that have been killed overseas who were propagandists for the enemy. So it is conceivable that an American citizen could be exchanging information and say something derogatory about us or something in favor of the enemy, and that could be considered to be that person's now a propagandist. My point is that shouldn't they have a day in court to determine the facts and have representation as opposed to being plucked up and saying, you're going to Guantanamo Bay for the rest of your life because you made some criticism that it's now the state has deemed you an enemy?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And that is precisely why we need these protections. And that helps illustrate the slippery slope nature of this problem. And it also emphasizes why it is that if there are some in our body who want to make sure this power exists in the government, that we must pass legislation affirmatively making it so, expressly providing that power, rather than doing it indirectly. That's all our amendment does. This is indeed a slippery slope. If all you have to do to indefinitely detain someone without charge, without trial, suspending their rights under the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 8th Amendments, if that's all you have to do is charge them in a certain way, then our constitutional protections have become weakened indeed, weakened to a dangerous degree.
And is it currently true that this amendment's being blocked by one senator from gaining a vote?
We're trying to get a vote. This got a vote in 2012. This received 67 votes, votes from people of both parties, votes from some members, including at least one person who you may be thinking of who has objections to it now. And so we need this to get a vote. If we are going to vote on other amendments, which we should be doing, this should get a vote. Nobody has explained to me why this should not, at a minimum, receive the vote. If someone doesn't like this, fine, let them vote against it. But we should have a vote on this because this is very relevant to the National Defense Authorization Act. It was, after all, the National Defense Authorization Act passed in 2011 that was the vehicle for enacting this into law.
And I guess one concluding point I would make would be that we have time in the Senate body to vote about which rockets we're going to use, made in which state and which country. Shouldn't we take time to vote about the abrogation or the possible abrogation of the Bill of Rights, of the right to a trial by jury. I think that this is an eminently important issue, should not be pushed under the rug, and that no one should be afraid to take a stand. Not everyone will agree, but we should be allowed to take a stand on the Senate floor, openly debate, and have a vote on whether or not you will have your right to trial by jury, or whether or not we're going to abbreviate that right and say we are at war. But realize, if you think that your rights can be abbreviated in times of war, that this is a war, that the people who tell you they're going to abbreviate your rights are also telling you that this war has no end, that there is no conceivable end to this war, and that the diminishment of your liberty, the loss of your right to trial by jury, will go on and on without end. I wholeheartedly support my fellow senator from Utah's amendment, and I advocate for having a vote on the Senate floor.
I agree, and I note the presence of my distinguished colleague from California, and I yield the floor so she can address the body.
I thank the senator, Mr. President.
Senator from California.
Thank you very much. I've listened to this debate, and I rise to urge my colleagues to allow a vote on this due process guarantee amendment. Senator Lee has filed it. I am a co-sponsor, and I'm delighted to be a co-sponsor. We actually voted on an earlier version of this amendment in 2012, so this is nothing new. What members may not recall is that it passed with 67 votes as an amendment to this bill in 2013. I'll also note that thanks to then Chairman Leahy, the bill on which this amendment is based had a hearing in the Judiciary Committee on February 29, 2012. So this bill has come before this body before. It got 67 votes, and it's had a hearing in the Judiciary Committee 3 years ago. Unfortunately, the amendment was taken out of the NDAA in conference that year. So it's my hope that the Senate will pass this amendment again this year, and that the House will support it, so that the law will clearly protect Americans in the United States from indefinite detention by their own government. Now members may say, well, this isn't going to happen. We're not going to do this, but we have done it. And I remember as a small child going just south of San Francisco to a racetrack called Tanforan, and it wasn't a racetrack. It was a detention center for Japanese Americans during World War II. And there were hundreds of families housed there for years against their will. To prevent this from ever happening again, Congress passed and President Nixon signed into law the Non-Detention Act of 1971, which clearly states, and I quote, "No citizen shall be imprisoned or otherwise detained by the United States except pursuant to an act of Congress." Now, that sounds good, but it didn't go far enough. Despite the shameful history of indefinite detention of Americans and the legal controversy since 9/11, some in the Senate have advocated for the indefinite detention of U.S. citizens during debate on the defense authorization bill in past years. These members have argued that the Supreme Court's plurality decision in the 2004 case of Hamdi v. Rumsfeld supports their view. However, the Hamdi case involved an American captured by the United States military on the battlefield in Afghanistan. Yasser Esam Hamdi was a U.S. citizen who took up arms on behalf of the Taliban, and he was captured on the battlefield in Afghanistan, not on United States soil. That's the difference. While the Supreme Court did effectively uphold Hamdi's military detention, the Supreme Court did not accept the government's broad assertions of executive authority to detain citizens without charge or trial. In fact, the Hamdi decision says clearly that it covers only, and I quote, individuals falling into the limited category we are considering, end quote. And it did not foreclose the possibility that indefinite detention of a United States citizen would raise a constitutional problem at a later date. Since Hamdi was decided in 2004, decisions by the lower courts have contributed to the legal ambiguity when it comes to the detention of U.S. citizens apprehended in our very own country. You can look at the case of Jose Padilla. He's a United States citizen arrested in Chicago in 2002. Padilla was initially detained by the Bush administration under a material witness warrant based on the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and later designated as an enemy combatant who allegedly conspired with Al-Qaeda to carry out terrorist attacks, including a plot to detonate a dirty bomb inside our country. Padilla was transferred to a military brig in South Carolina, where he was detained for 3.5 years while seeking his freedom by filing a writ of habeas corpus in federal court. Now, it's important to note that Padilla was never charged with attempting to carry out the dirty bomb plot. Instead, he was released from military custody in November 2005 and transferred to civilian federal custody in Florida, where he was indicted on other charges in federal court related to terrorist plots overseas. In a 2003 decision by the circuit court known as Padilla v. Rumsfeld, the Court of Appeals held that the 2001 authorization for use of military force, which we call the AUMF, did not authorize Padilla's military detention. The decision stated, and I quote, "We conclude that clear congressional authorization is required for detentions of American citizens on American soil because 18 U.S.C. 401A, the Non-Detention Act, prohibits such detentions absent specific congressional authorization," end quote. So, the Padilla case bounced back and forth from the Second Circuit up to the Supreme Court, then to the Fourth Circuit, and the legality of his military detention was never conclusively resolved. Thus, there remains ambiguity about whether a congressional authorization for the use of military force permits the indefinite detention of United States citizens arrested on United States soil. So let me say over 12 years, let me repeat, 12 years after Padilla was initially arrested and detained, he was finally sentenced to 21 years in prison in 2014. The simple point, Mr. President, is that we can protect national security while also ensuring that the constitutional due process rights of every American captured within the United States are protected. That's what this amendment would do. Like the amendment that passed here in 2012 with 67 votes on this floor, this amendment would prevent the government from using a general authorization for the use of military force to apprehend Americans at home and detain them without charge or trial indefinitely. So no one could be picked up and charged and not charged and held indefinitely, which is now permissible. It states very simply, this is our legislation, and I quote, "A general authorization to use military force, a declaration of war, or any similar authority on its own shall not be construed to authorize the imprisonment or detention without charge or trial of a citizen or lawful permanent resident of the United States apprehended in the United States, end quote. The amendment also modifies the existing subsection A of the Non-Detention Act. So it covers lawful permanent residents of the United States and ensures that any detention is consistent with the Constitution. So new subsection A will read, and I quote, "No citizen or lawful permanent resident shall be imprisoned or otherwise detained by the United States except pursuant to an act of Congress that expressly authorizes such imprisonment or detention." Now, let me explain the impact of these changes to the law. First, the United States government will continue to be able to detain U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents on a foreign battlefield pursuant to an authorization to use military force, like what we passed after 9/11. That AUMF provides the authority to detain Al-Qaeda, ISIL, and affiliated terrorist fighters. In other words, if the government needs to detain an enemy combatant on a foreign battlefield under a post-9/11 congressional authorization to use force, that's not barred, even if the enemy combatant is, in fact, a U.S. citizen. Indeed, the Supreme Court held in Hamdi that the AUMF is, quote, "explicit authorization," end quote, for that limited kind of detention. So the amendment does not disturb the Hamdi decision. Second, when acting with respect to citizens or lawful permanent residents apprehended at home, the amendment makes clear that a general authorization for use of military force does not authorize the detention without charge or trial of citizens or green card holders, like Padilla, who are apprehended inside the United States. Instead, he should be arrested and charged, like other terrorists captured in the United States. Now, the simple point is, indefinite military detention of Americans apprehended in the United States is not the American way and must not be allowed. In the United States, the FBI and other law enforcement and intelligence agencies have proven time and time again that they're up to the challenge of detecting, stopping, arresting, and convicting terrorists found on United States soil. Our law enforcement personnel have successfully arrested, detained, and convicted, literally, hundreds of terrorists, both before and after 9/11. Specifically, there were 580 terrorism-related convictions in the federal criminal court between 9/11 and the end of 2014. That's according to the Department of Justice. And more recently, federal prosecutors have charged 85 men and women around our country in connection with ISIL since March of 2014. Suspected terrorists can still be detained within the United States criminal justice system using at least the following four options. One, they can be charged with a federal or state crime and held. Two, some can be held for violating immigration laws. Three, they can be held as a material witness as part of a federal grand jury proceeding. Or four, they can be detained under Section 412 of the Patriot Act, which provides that an alien may be detained for up to 6 months if their release, quote, will threaten the national security of the United States or the safety of the community of any person, end quote. Simply put, there is no shortage of authority for United States law enforcement to take the necessary actions on our soil to protect the homeland. Some may ask why this legislation protects green card holders as well as citizens. And others may ask why the bill does not protect all persons apprehended in the United States from indefinite military detention. And let me make clear, I would support providing the protections in this amendment to all persons in the United States. But the question comes, there isn't political support to expand it to cover others besides U.S. citizens and green card holders. We went through this in 2012, I believe, Mr. President, before you were here. The overriding situation is to prevent the federal government from moving in and picking up Americans and holding them without charge or trial, as was done with Japanese Americans after World War II. And finally, with the passage of this, we will close out that chapter once and for all. So this isn't about whether citizens apprehended in the United States like Jose Padilla or others who would do us harm should be captured, interrogated, incarcerated, and severely punished. They should be, to the fullest extent the law allows, but not an innocent American picked up off the street and held without charge or trial. Not because of somebody's name or looks or heritage. So what about how a future president might abuse the authority to indefinitely detain people militarily here in the United States? Our Constitution gives everyone in the United States basic due process rights. The Fifth Amendment provides no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And this is a basic tenet of our Constitution and our values. People are entitled to notice of charges, to an opportunity to be heard, and to a fair proceeding before a neutral arbiter. In criminal cases, the accused also has a right to be speedy, to a speedy and public trial by a jury of their peers. So these protections are really a sacred part of who we are as Americans. And I think it's something we all take great pride in, and that now is once again the time. We did this in 2012 in the 2013 NDAA bill. It received 67 votes on this floor. And I would hope that we would not be blocked from taking another vote on this. We experimented with indefinite detention during World War II. It's a mistake we all realize and a betrayal of our core values. So let's not repeat it. I want to thank Senator Lee, Senator Tom Udall, Senator Paul, Senator Cruz, and others who have worked with us on this issue over the years, and I urge my colleagues to support the amendment. I yield the floor. Thank you very much, Mr. President.
Okay, welcome back. This is George Butler, Secret Truth. Yeah, you can find us every Saturday night here in Austin, Texas on 89.1 FM. And we're also, our website is thesecrettruth.com. You can go in there and call up our programs. They're available sometimes as late as Friday and or all day Saturday and so forth after that. And we appreciate you making any comments that you would like to on our website and so forth. But we have a weekly program, and we've been on the air for over 10 years. So anyway, I want to thank you very much for listening, and welcome back to the remaining part of this first hour. This National Defense Authorization Act is not a good law. It should have never been enacted. We're coming off of the 9/11 attack, and there are many people out there that are subscribers to a 9/11 truth. And I support the 9/11 truth movement and the fact that I don't think that we had a very good, conclusive, you could say, investigation on 9/11. And I just think that we need to go and do more of that and do a greater, work in the area of 9/11 and have a better investigation, a more unbiased, more lengthy, drawn out, more detailed, and get a lot more facts behind that than we got. But anyway, we're going to get into a few other things here, the news with Berlin and so forth, but we'll be back. Other news this week concerned last Friday's attack on a crowd in Berlin, and a Tunisian finally was found later in Italy after fleeing the scene, and he was shot dead by one of two Italian police. But anyway, there was an attack there Friday. A truck went through a crowd and killed at least 12 and injured dozens of others. And so we're still looking at these attacks that are taking place in Europe. And they just flooded the jihadists in there. And many of the immigrants were of fighting age, and men like this Tunisian was. And so we're not going to see a very, very happy ending to the European problem. And Merkel, Chancellor Merkel, she is under attack, and rightfully so. She should lose all power in Germany. It's inexcusable, the actions that she's taken. The actions that she's taken have been against the good security and the safety and security of the good German people. And they're rising up in arms now. This influx of immigrants into Europe has set off a rise of nationalism, never before seen in Europe. And France has the Le Pen is coming on throne now, and so forth. And we're not going to see this abated until the Europeans can begin to control somewhat this jihadist, this Islamic problem over there. And some are saying that Islam itself is not only a religion, but it functions like a theocracy would. A theocracy would be a religion that would be a state religion, so it would be a religion that becomes the political rule also. So it has those tendencies in whatever country that it begins to be to expand in. And the population rate of birth rate is much higher within those Islamic families, no matter where they're from, than your normal European families. And so what you do is you have a result of an increasing Islamic Muslim population in those areas, especially in France today. So I don't see that abating anytime soon. But Merkel is leading the way of what not to do. See, and the German people they're going to take things into their own hands here, and they've already started rebelling somewhat against some of the government types of seizures of some of their rental property. I mean their own apartments and giving those to the immigrants and so forth. And the German people they're not going to put up with this much longer. I just don't see that that is one of the alternatives that the Germans have. But we'll just have to wait and see. Carrie Fisher came down 15 minutes away from her set down in Los Angeles airport. Had a heart attack. It's being described as a massive heart attack now. I think she's going to be in this latest Star Trek movie coming up. But they wanted her to lose a tremendous amount of weight or some weight to do that. But I think 15 minutes out from Los Angeles, she came down with this illness. And I think they controlled it somewhat. And they had to go straight there to the airport, the closest place to get medical attention. And they did get on the ground. They did get carried into an intensive care unit, and I think she's out of that now, and I think she's seeing her close of kin, her next of kin now in her hospital room. But we'd like to pray for her. And, you know, I mean, these illnesses can just come on out of nowhere sometime. But anyway, we have this settlement, United Nations Security Council vote that just took place. And I mentioned this at the top of the hour of the program. And President-elect Trump took an unprecedented sort of meddling in a way into foreign policy, even though he's not the president yet. But I guess Obama would describe it, or his administration would describe it, as meddling into affairs that are not his totally. So anyway, that did occur. And so I don't know what's going to come, you know, out of that. I think he was trying to persuade Egypt to withdraw the resolution, which they did not. It was voted on. It was, I think, the United States abstained, but it was voted on and did clear the Security Council. So the resolution basically is calling for a halt of any further settlements in the West Bank by the Israelis. So the Israelis are fighting mad about this. Netanyahu, who is very close to Trump and his administration, through Romney, in fact, I think Romney and Netanyahu are friends, does not like this vote at all. They've tried to deny the Palestinian statehood, and I think it might have something to do with the oil discoveries off the coast of Gaza Strip and Israel. There's tremendous gas reserves out there that have been discovered. And in the Golan Heights, I believe there's also gas reserves and so forth that are being mined and being explored. And so this might be some of the reasons why the Israelis are not wanting to do that. I think the Trump administration, the incoming administration, is very close to Netanyahu and to the Israeli, you know, policies. And so it remains to be seen how far, you know, he'll advance their interest, or will he be fairly reasonable in providing them policies that are fair to both the Palestinians and the Israelis. Trump is going to be undergoing a metamorphosis, I hope, from a wheeler-dealer corporate head to the presidency, was sitting on the desk in the Oval Office of the Office of the Presidency, which is not a wheeling and dealing operation. It's one that requires an astuteness and a statesmanship like that most people have can never you know, equal. So there have been very few presidents in the last few years that have attained a very statesmanlike level in that position. But I hope and pray that Donald John Trump, will meet the challenge. And he can meet challenges, I will say that. Over the years, he's up to the level of meeting challenges for sure. And I just hope that he does meet that challenge. This is George Butler signing off, thesecrettruth.com. We maintain that we try to be very fair and balanced, but we try to tell it like it is, too. We're not out here. We don't call names. We don't do any name-calling. We say what we believe the truth to be. So the secret truth is what we're for, and we're trying to publicize that in a very, very nice way. But thank you for listening, and tune in to us in 89.1 in Austin, Texas, every Saturday night. Thank you for listening, and God bless each and every one of you.